Prague, now broadcasting in English. You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. In the last few weeks, Veronica Hicks has been reading from the memoirs of Jaroslava Skleničková, If I Had Been a Boy, I Would Have Been Shot. Today you can hear another part of this extraordinary story of survival. Then it will be time to go places, and today we'll take you on a trip to the town of Kutná Hora. And finally, you can hear another edition in David Vaughan's popular series From the Archives, which Radio Prague is currently repeating. So please do stay with us as we now turn to a fresh edition of Czech books. In the last few weeks, Veronica Hicks has been reading from the memoirs of Jaroslava Skleničková, an extraordinary story of survival in war. We have now reached May 1945. After nearly 3 years in Ravensbrück, the women of Lidice are now free, although they still face the trauma of returning home to find that the village has been wiped off the map and that all their menfolk and nearly all their children are dead. David Vaughan introduces the eighth episode.
At this stage in the book, Jaroslava Skleničková pauses to reflect. After surviving the death march from the Ravensbrück concentration camp, the women of Lidice are now free, finding shelter for a few days in the North German town of Güstrow, which is now held by the Russians, and waiting impatiently to return home. They have been through a living hell. For 3 years, all the women of an entire village, regardless of their age, politics or social standing, have been kept together in a single cramped barrack, with scarcely enough food to survive. Before describing the pain of their return, Jaroslava reflects on what the experience of the camp meant for her, how it changed her views of human nature, of politics, and her own life. Veronica Hicks reads.
Understanding. My arrival in Ravensbrück enabled me to get acquainted with the most varied forms of heroism, selflessness, sacrifice, and solidarity. It was a great school, and indeed the only bonus I had from the concentration camp for my future life. The concentration camp showed everyone in the nakedness of their character. There was no use to pretend when a person didn't know whether he or she would still be alive the next day. Also, I had grown up in a family which was not concerned with politics, and at that age I had no idea what politics were. Gradually I began to look around me and compare the behaviour of the so-called right wing on the one hand, and of the left wing, that is, the communists, on the other. I arrived at the conclusion that character must be a part of a person, no matter on which side he or she is standing, and which political attitude he or she has assumed. When they transported us to the camp, among the first to approach us were Anička Kvapilová and Milena Šeborová, who provided us with writing paper and stamps so that we could write to relatives. That was the right wing. I also had an opportunity to meet the leader of the Communist Party in the concentration camp, Joška Jaburková, though after our arrival, she had only 2 months to live. She came to our barrack on the very first evening, and she made a great impression on me. Our women started to tell her that we were in the camp by mistake, and that we would soon be going home. She answered that no one yet had left a concentration camp, but we mustn't lose heart, that soon the war would be over, and advised us to set an end, say, to when the plums are ripe, or to October the 28th, the Czechoslovak National Day, or to Christmas, or something similar. In the Czech barrack, a cultural afternoon was held on Sundays when there was no need to work. An actress from the Voskovets and Verich Theatre in Prague, Vlasta Faberová, used to recite. A dancer from the D-34 Theatre, Nina Jirsíková, who after the war was a choreographer in the Prague State Opera, was accompanied in her performances by arias from operas sung by Miladka Šimčíková, who was taught to sing by the famous Emmy Destin. It was chiefly Anička Kvapilová who, to a considerable degree, took cultural matters into her hands. Her colleague from the Municipal Library in Prague sent her, in small parcels, the whole of Macha's romantic epic poem, Mai, and the girls practiced its recital. Poems were also passed around in the camp, whether composed by the girls or what we remembered from home. We learned these from each other during the long roll calls. I knew about 30 of them by heart, but Mila remembered far more. We mostly made friends in work columns, and did so also with persons of various nationalities. Within these friendships, gifts were sometimes exchanged, our own poems, a picture, little pouches sewn from scraps of material, a little animal carved from toothbrushes and so on. It is now hard to describe how much these treasures meant to us. We each of us cherished them. But where to hide them? The only pocket we had was the one in our pinafore, but in it we were not allowed to put anything but a handkerchief, the last letter from home, and a piece of pencil with which we wrote our letters. Anything a person wanted to save in some way was worn under the dresses in a secretly sewn little cloth bag on a string. The biggest professional in this concealing was our mamma, who carried that way not only various bits and pieces, but also Auntie's wedding ring. When we first came to the camp, women were allowed to keep their wedding rings, but after about 6 months, we were ordered to hand in everything. Auntie was afraid, so Mama carried it for her, wound around with black thread so that it wasn't shiny. She would say, "I shall always have enough time to shove it into the ground." In the end, she even brought it back home to give to Doník in remembrance of his mother, who perished in the gas chamber in the concentration camp. Sadly, poor Doník did not return either, and the ring has remained with me to this day. Mama, Mila and I also gave each other little gifts on our birthdays, but never for Christmas, because without Papa it was not Christmas. Only on Christmas Eve, in the evening, we would go to the big decorated fir tree which the guards had erected in front of their own canteen. There we stood for a while and reminisced. Mama also collected recipes from fellow inmates, which she wrote on scraps torn from newspapers that we were given for the lavatory. She looked for blank spaces between the lines, at the edges or left after censorship. She probably wanted to bring Papa something to show him that she has always kept him in her mind. She sewed through the cuttings to keep them together, and thus made a small cookery book. I tried quite a few of the recipes after the war, and if visitors enjoyed them, I would say, "Those are concentration camp biscuits."
That was the eighth part of Yaroslava Skleničková's moving memoirs. You will find the previous editions on Radio Prague's website at www.radio.cz. Now it's time to go places, and your guide today is Jan Wellinger.
Without question, the town of Kutná Hora in central Bohemia is a must-see destination for anyone visiting the Czech Republic, a town with a long and fascinating history. In the 13th and 14th centuries, the site became increasingly famous for silver deposits which drew miners and production that would eventually account for as much as a third of all the silver production in Europe. Vlaskimil Pospíšil is a local guide.
The history of Kutná Hora is very connected with silver mining already in the end of 13th century. First, very rich Germanese miners came to the area and they founded and completed here. First, all this miners' village, because in this period was discovered a lot of silver, and started here typical silver rush.
The prospect of wealth early on saw Kutná Hora grow rapidly, swelling into a mine settlement sprawling with new neighborhoods. Eventually, Kutná Hora gelled into a single community, becoming the second most important town in the Kingdom of Bohemia.
Kutná Hora, it's possible to say in the beginning of 14th century, was second most important town in Bohemian Kingdom after main capital Prague with probably 60,000 inhabitants, many various nationals. But it's possible to say that Kutná Hora mainly in the beginning of 14th century was a typical German town.
The early 1300s saw a number of significant developments, among them King Wenceslas II's introduction of new mining legislation. The king established the so-called Prague Groschen, a new currency with a fixed content of silver. Nevertheless, its amount at 90% silver and 10% copper would vary over the decades, depending on the town's economic fortunes. Later, mid-13th century, a fortified castle now known as Vlašský dvůr, or the Italian courtyard, was established, which would become the site of the royal mint and treasury, along with smithies and a coin-striking works. A royal residence was also established for use by Czech kings.
It's possible to say that second very important period for Italian court started in the end of 14th century, between 1390 to 1400. Why? It was period Bohemian king, which was named Wenceslas IV. And Wenceslas IV liked to visit many times our nice river town, and Italian court was for him very interesting place. And he decided, completed here second private royal seat, royal residence, royal palace. Standing now inside the royal treasury in Italian court, and now in front of you can see originally Gothic stone portal as a central entrance to the royal treasury. It was private properties only for Bohemian kings.
Due to its enormous wealth, Kutná Hora also saw the establishment of the prestigious St. Barbara's Cathedral in 1388. Builders intended for it to rival Prague's own St. Vitus's, and both are excellent examples of Gothic architecture in Bohemia. Like St. Vitus's in Prague, St. Barbara's in Kutná Hora took more than 500 years to complete. To this day, it remains one of Kutná Hora's most persistent symbols, a constant silhouette on the hilltop overlooking the town. Back at the mint, we're just about to see a demonstration of how master minters worked. Traditionally, 15 were employed hammering out an incredible 2,000 coins over 12 hours each day, 7 days a week. Says Rudolf Bezvoda, who greets tourists viewing the mint, many of those master minters eventually lost their hearing from the constant clanging of hammers. And although they were extremely well paid in their day, not many lived to what one would call a ripe old age. But it was perhaps even worse for local prisoners.
Protože tady to byl takový trest ve vlastním dvoře, no, že prostě když někdo něco prodal, tak musel držet. No.
Local crooks who had been caught had to help by placing or setting the coin. And if the minter happened to miss, they got the full hammer's blow across their fingers. There's even a saying in Czech that when you're bad, you get whacked across your fingers. The prisoners had to put up with it for a month, and if they weren't crippled by the end of it, they stood a chance of getting pardoned.
Češi jsou experti na vymýšlení, tak když to byl bohatý zloděj, tak se domluvil s tím pregéřem a měsíc to vydržel a po měsíci dostal milost.
All I can say is ouch. Kutná Hora is not just the mint. There are many other notable sites worth seeing, like St. Barbara's, and during the high season, tourists can still view part of an old mine shaft. It's not for the claustrophobic, but it should be quite the experience. All other mines were long closed down, long flooded. The deepest went 500 meters down. Kutná Hora's suburb of Sedlec, meanwhile, is also home to a unique bone chapel, where thousands were once buried. 30,000 alone in 1318. In the late 19th century, the Czech woodcarver František Rindt arranged a great many of the bones and skulls, which had long been bleached and disinfected, into decorative patterns, including an astounding bone chandelier. The decorations are meant to express the fleeting nature of existence. At the chapel, I spoke to a number of Canadian and Swiss students who said they'd never seen anything like it. In their words, end this edition of Spotlight this day.
A little bit crazy, but it's good, yes.
Never seen it before, but that's not spooky.
Definitely very haunting. It's very beautiful, decorative, but I mean, I find it really beautiful and really striking, and I'm just in awe of it. It's really quite strange just to see this many skeletons in one place at one time, and then to see them so beautifully arranged is just striking.
That edition of Spotlight with Jan Wellinger was first aired in March of 2007. And now it's time to take a walk down memory lane. Here is another edition of David Vaughan's popular series of From the Archives.
In November 1945, 6 months after the end of World War II, the units that had taken part in liberating Czechoslovakia began their official withdrawal. Various ceremonies were held, first on November the 15th, to say farewell to the Red Army troops who had fought their way in bitter fighting through Slovakia all the way to Prague. Then, a few days later, on November the 20th, the withdrawal began of the American units that had liberated Western Bohemia. The wartime Allied Supreme Commander, Dwight Eisenhower, came to Prague, where he was given an enthusiastic welcome.
This is my first visit to Prague, and I'm very honored to be here. I've had a gorgeous reception, and if the people of Prague feel as good about this meeting as I do, then we're all very happy. Thank you.
Czechoslovakia's President Edvard Beneš and Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk were sincere in their warmth towards the American troops. Jan Masaryk, the son of Czechoslovakia's first president, Tomáš Masaryk, was himself American on his mother's side, and Edvard Beneš had never forgotten the role that President Woodrow Wilson had played in the foundation of Czechoslovakia back in 1918. So when Jan Masaryk said farewell to the American troops on a chilly late November day in Plzeň, the atmosphere was particularly warm.
General Harmon, Mr. Ambassador, to start all over again. General Harmon, Mr. Ambassador, officers and soldiers of the American Army. I'm going to say a few words in English. I'm not going to be long. It's too cold for long speeches. During the last war, Woodrow Wilson, your great president, took a very definite stand about the settlement of the war and the establishing of peace. He failed. He did not fail personally, but politicians made the realization of his ideas impossible. Woodrow Wilson helped to discover Czechoslovakia. It took just 20 years, and another war, this time infinitely more cruel than the last one, was upon us. During this war, Franklin Roosevelt, who knew very well from the beginning that America was going to be in it and prepared your great democracy for it, was equally helpful in rediscovering Czechoslovakia from the haze, fog, and dirt of Munich. It was my never-to-be-forgotten privilege to discuss with him the war and the peace during my frequent war visits to the United States of America. You, young Americans, rediscovered Czechoslovakia a few months ago. You came at the moment of the greatest emergency the lovely land of Bohemia has ever experienced. You helped to free us, and you stayed while we were catching our breath after 7 years of hell, which were longer than 7 times 70 years. Now you are about to leave us, and I am here to say thank you and God bless you. Westward Ho is your program now. You will be going home, and how true the song is, there is no place like home. May I thank you in all humility for making it possible for me and my colleagues to come home. I was homesick for 7 years, and homesickness can hurt more than any other affliction. Soon, you will be passing that symbolic lady, the Statue of Liberty. Will you please tell her for us that we too believe in liberty, that we refuse to live without liberty? Our ways may be different. We are a small country with a great tradition of freedom. We shall not give it up. God bless America and you, her sons, who fought so well to save the world. You did a swell job. God bless you.
There was a tragic irony to Masaryk's words about Czechoslovakia not giving up its freedom. Just over 2 years later, the communists staged a political coup in the country, and 2 weeks after that, Jan Masaryk was found lying dead in the courtyard of the Foreign Ministry.
David Vaughan with From the Archives, and I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. Should you like to contact us, then our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you as always. This is Danielle Lazarova saying thanks for joining us and take care.
écouter.